Football on Off the Ball.
Well, I think man management is far more nuanced nowadays, as you're suggesting, because the dressing rooms have changed. You've got players from different faiths, different cultures, different communities, and you've got to reflect all that. These are player whisperers as well as player shouters.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
This is Off the Ball Breakfast.
Ireland's sports breakfast show.
Morning, good morning, Vinny.
Good morning, how are you, Shane?
Keeping well. And Arthur O'Day, good morning to you.
That's Craig.
Keeping well. Loads to get into, lads, in the back pages, but we might start with the game last night at the GTEC because, well, the title race certainly isn't over yet. Probably expected this to be banana skin for this Arsenal team, and Brentford have been in serious form, Vinny, but really, really good game in parts. Maybe the first half took a little bit. Igor Thiago's chance was about all there was to speak to, but second half, chances galore, and Quívan Kelleher with a big save towards the end as well. So, good point for Brentford, and it could have been a good point as well for Arsenal in the end, because Brentford could have won the game.
Yeah, I think in one sense it was a good point for Arsenal in terms of, I don't mean they hung on, but there was a lot of big moments went away as well. Thiago could have scored a couple of times. He was outstanding, and obviously Raya had to make at least one big, big save. So it's a little bit, this one, where do you fall on it? Like, leading, like, some people think it's easier to chase somebody down. I think most people in football would prefer, no matter whether you're trying to win the league and the United Churches League, all the way, to have the points in the bag. 4 points is better than the other way around. But yeah, it's I think Arsenal are lucky that they don't have another Premiership game this weekend, and they have a little bit of breathing space, because I think there'll be a ramped up pressure. I think their next game is Wolves next week, so away from home, and then the North London Derby, so new manager in there. So yeah, I think they've a little bit of breathing space now, and they need it. I wouldn't say there were signs of nerves yesterday. They just played against a good side.
Yeah,
caused them problems.
Organised.
Yeah.
I'm just curious. How do you entertain that? Would there be anxiety?
Yeah, there would be, especially when it's your first one. I would say, do you know what I mean? For a lot, I think almost everybody haven't won it before, within reason, Jesus, and there's a couple of players in the background. But yeah, I think there would be, even for the manager, he hasn't experienced that as a manager. So there's an element of that where I think if you flipped it and City were 4 points ahead, you would say, wasn't a bad point yesterday. I think it does. There will be a nervousness around everybody. You're always watching over your shoulder. Even I've had experience where I've been 6 and 9 points ahead with 5 and 6 and 7 games left. You still don't feel you're over the line. Mm. And people will, we'll sit here and go, well, the league is wrapped up. But as a coach, you don't think that. You still go, well, we need 4 points over our last 5 games.
Yeah.
I think our team in 19, the last time we won the league, we won a game to go 15 points clear with 5 games left or 4 games left. And it was only that night you felt you won the league. Mm-hmm. So I think you were going into that game 12, I think it was 12 points clear with 5 games left. It didn't still feel like, it must have been 9 with 5 games left.
Yeah.
That's not home and hosed when you're in that moment.
Are you having to attune yourself to that? Is there any part, because if you were on the outside looking in, you'd go that's done. Basis of probability, as an onlooker. Last year, even with Shamrock Rovers, when they're kind of dragging it over the line a little bit, you're like, it's still done. So it's just an automatic change. It's not like you're having to remind yourself and keep yourself focused. You can't drift
I think if you do, it's so dangerous. And there has been the odd spectacular fail, we all know that, but by and large, no, you don't feel you're done until that last moment. Yeah, you really don't.
Mm.
I mean, it's probably what keeps you on the edge, and that's the good thing, that way. You might have an element, so if you think about it, you might have 25 players between your squad staff. There might be certain 10 people who switch off a little bit and go, we're done, we're 9 points clear. 5 games left, we only need one more win. But if you think like that, the fallout is huge, And you certainly wouldn't pick a team going, we're clear, so we'll leave him out today just to give a fella a run. You don't find fellas doing that, because that's what then the rest of your group go, right, we've switched off here. So that's why you'll make whatever you want to get done as quickly as you can.
Yeah, I'd say it's hard to stop that from festering in a dressing room, is it? You know, if a certain cohort of players, three or four players, starting to like not half celebrate, but you almost get the attitude that there's one hand on the trophy, and that can be tough to arrest in a dressing room.
Oh yeah it is. Yeah. As soon as you get that, then you have a problem. And a little bit, like what you often find is the top teams, whether it's in League of Ireland, whether it's in the Premier League, they'll still have a Champions League. That's why being in the FA Cup or the Champions League, people will say you're nearly better not having them, but it's the other way around. It keeps people on their toes. It keeps the sharpness. You go from game to game to game to game. You end up playing every 3 or 4 days. So training is quite light. You're not around each other as much as you normally would be, but it's like you're on game mode constantly. And for that reason, then that's what keeps you sharp. But we're at the stage now where when you're 6-9 points clear, you sleep a little bit better.
Yeah.
But you still wake up at 4 a.m. as a coach going, 9 points. You just start seeing scenarios, and you almost see, you could be playing a team second or third from the bottom, and then you start seeing their strengths and going, you could cause a problem. And it's just what the mind does to you.
Mm.
So if you're like Mikel Arteta now, how are you framing, I don't know how you frame these things, if it's just one overall thing for the season, if there's week by week, you're kind of trying to frame a different mood, or day by day, but like, how's he framing that to them when he's talking to them this week?
I think it's a fine balance by being positive all the time and saying that was a really good point. So what he might say on mic in an interview, and you have to be careful, particularly when you're away from home, what you don't want to do is throw the teacups around where other ears are listening. So you might have to wait till you're in the dressing room or at the training ground, your own place. The problem with that is it loses a little bit of its feeling, because you've lost your own little bit of anger, but there's a time and a place for throwing a few F's into players in that when you're comfortable, and then there's another time and a place where you go, stay calm, this was always going to be difficult. But you can't keep saying that all the time. So when a 9 point lead becomes 4 points, you can't keep saying, we're grand. So he has to find a balance with that. But ultimately, I don't think there's a right or wrong with that. He has to know the group and who needs a little bit of a kick and who doesn't. So it's fine. It is a difficult balancing act. Confidence, momentum, all of that stuff that people don't think exists sometimes is huge in a run-in when you've got... obviously, we're comparing apples and oranges in terms of... But I remember having it in 19 where we played a game every 3 days, FAI Cup games, European games, league games, and every one of them had some meaning to it. By and large, we won them, but there's times where a draw... You're able to go into the dressing room, lads are down, they're flat, we only drew, we should have beat them. And you've got to go in and go, we're like, first world problem here, we're great. So it's finding that balance with it.
For the tail of the tape, for anyone who didn't see the game last night, so essentially Arsenal-Brentford at the GTEC finishes 1-1, Arsenal now on 57 points, the 26 games played, so 4 clear of Manchester City, who have the same amount of games played, and 7 clear of Aston Villa back in third. So it's quite enough first half. As I said, Eze comes off at half time, Martin Odegaard replaces him, and then on the hour mark, Noni Madueke with a brilliant header back across himself. Quiven Keller maybe didn't look quite set for it, a lovely little loft across from Hincapié as well, and then 10 minutes later on 70 minutes Keane Lewis Potter gets the equaliser. Vandenberg flicks on from a throw in. Maybe some credit to Stephen Rice, the Brentford set piece coach, on that one as well.
Rice is there, another one of that pro licence crew. A lot of people in the FAI know him, so it's great to see, you see them familiar faces, like former Shamrock Rovers man, he's been around the league, all of that stuff, and to end up there, it's a wonderful achievement. But it's funny, I was just thinking last night when that went in, it looked like he was about to take him off. And you're going, when things as a manager is going well, they're going bloody well. It's a little bit like, so say at the end of the season somebody came looking for Keith, like it's easy for us to go, you have to stay where you are, that train only goes past every so often. Like, it's a bit like Thomas Frank now. He's probably, how hard must it be for him to lose his job, but also looking at his previous club being successful. has to like has to play in your mind.
And yet it doesn't mean that his decision was wrong.
No,
to go
it doesn't.
To Tottenham, even
but, but it's easy to say it is wrong.
Yeah,
you know,
hindsight.
It's easy to say that. You have to feel you can do better.
Yeah.
What do you put it down to their Brentford season? Because I was just thinking about last night, and I don't. It was an interesting. I saw a thing in the week. There was a headline in one of the papers, and it was something about Sesko, because he's obviously from United. He scored 2 and 3 now off the bench, looks kind of lively. And there was a thing in the headline that kind of said, like, effectively, Carrick has him going. I was kind of thinking, it's one of those things where it's such a catch-all that he represents everything that's now kind of going all right for Man United. So I was kind of thinking last night about Andrews, and it was like, obviously, he came into that role with limited experience, the job he's been asked to do, fairly difficult circumstances with the players they lost. And it's gone so well. And I was kind of thinking, it's like, is he a genius? Is he, is it circumstances, far bigger circumstances, and he's an effective cog in it? Maybe we don't know. I was thinking, this is going crazily well. They're like 2 points off Liverpool now, who are having a bad season, but whatever. 40 points with about 12, 13 games to go.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, it's unprecedentedly well how it's going. So I was trying to think how much of that is down to him and how much is luck and how much is...
Timing, et cetera.
Timing. Maybe we'll never know. Maybe it's kind of, maybe you never know. And maybe it's like the Frank scenario is there. Frank looks like a fool now.
Yeah.
Whereas, 10 months ago, he was being interviewed for the United and Spurs jobs. And you're like, oh, this guy's a no-brainer. The root of that point is that, it can't be one or the other. Frank's not a fool or a genius. Andrews can't be a genius or a lucky general, whatever.
You can be lucky general, Arthur.
But the nuance of the thing must be mad, in terms of we must only see a chink of light of the whole thing that goes on underneath, of a guy's capabilities, what people are doing. I say you can't lay all this success at Keith Andrews' door no more than you can lay all the failure of the season at Thomas Frank's door for Spurs, if you know what I mean. But it gets boiled down to that. But I was just trying to wonder about Keith particularly.
Yeah, it's a really difficult one to answer because it wrecks my brain so often in the terms of I've played under some people who weren't that good but were brilliant and I've played under people who were brilliant at understanding the game but actually weren't that good
results wise.
Yeah, and so it's in simple terms, the way I sort of understand it in my head is to just pick two random clubs. So say I got this St. Pat's job next season. I could be gone after 10 games. But if I got the Shamrock Rovers job, I could be win 10 of them. So how does that make any sense? Sometimes you just fit in certain environments, and I think Keith fits into that environment. I think I spoke about this over the last week or two. I've done my pro license with Keith. Mm. He's not a genius. He's not brilliant on the game. But he has lots of really good attributes. He wasn't a standout candidate. He wasn't a bad candidate. He was very, very good. He was excellent at what Keith was good at. But you wouldn't have went through that group and went, Keith's going to be in the best league in the world, having a team flying, beating one of the best teams in the world in Arsenal, or drawing one of the best teams. So I think you're a sum of the whole part of the whole environment of all of them different things. And there's no doubt Keith's got a bit of luck. He was in the right place at the right time, but then he's taken that luck as well. Yeah. And he deserves huge credit for what he's done. It sounds like I'm being nearly critical of him. I'm not. Him and say Duffer done that course together. If Duffer had got the Brentford job, people on that done the course might have said Duffer would be ahead of Keith, right?
Mm.
But there's no guarantee Duffer would have got better results than what Keith is.
So personality thing sometimes.
So I know that's not answering the question because I'm not sure there is an answer to it.
I do get you, but what it's the interesting thing to me is then how it feels. And maybe this is a changing thing, and maybe football kind of catches up, but it sort of feels like the most difficult thing at the minute then would be to appoint a manager. Like, to know someone, as because your point there, perfect. If you put Keith Andrews in at Shelburne, does he do what Damien Duff does? Possibly not.
Possibly not.
You know? Really? So it's like, but it's such an interesting kind of thing then that how the hell do you know, and particularly from a manager's point of view, how the hell do you know if you're going into a job that that's the one to take, or that that's, because if you're saying, well, I don't know if it was before, on air or off air, but with Thomas Frank, it's a no-brainer for him with that Spurs job came up.
Yeah.
But I wonder in some part of him, if he stepped back to think about it, or if he ever, was he able to comprehend why this might go the way it has gone? Or do you, can you allow that in at all?
But it's all, it's the same argument around players. In terms of same argument, like Troy Parrott, stay where you are, you're scoring lots of goals, grand. But there is an element of, if it say, I don't know,
Everton or someone
comes
caught,
along and go, do you know what, avoid 20 goals with Everton, and then at potentially Manchester United or Arsenal or whatever. And you've got to, Thomas Frank, everyone has to dream bigger in all walks of life. So managers in football are no different. The only thing is, you wonder whether you get to a stage where, let's say, we won't talk about Keith because it's nearly too close for me to say that. Let's say Thomas Frank is on 3 million a year at Brentford. Why not be on 3 million a year for 10 years?
Yeah.
Right? Why do you need to be on 4 million? So I understand that argument, but you do want to test yourself.
Yeah.
But like,
Champions League football as well. Yeah. There was the lure of that with the Spurs job too, do you know?
Yeah. But like, and I'm sure people will text in or people will say, oh, stay where you are, blah, blah, blah. But like, it is Champions League football. It is the opportunity to work with better players. You always think you're better than you are. So it's such a difficult one. I would appoint Michael Carrick now if it was on the Manchester United board.
Why?
Because what you, and it's a bit, this is how I can answer it. Best answer your question is, it's the simplicity of what he's doing. It's the basics and giving people confidence. It's also somebody that knows what they're doing. Does a Britishness to what they're doing? And the same with Keith to a point, okay? I know he's 100% Irish, only from down the road, but what Carrick is doing, does a Britishness to it. It's like, I was here a couple of years ago, I think Colm wasn't having it at the time. He's not here to defend himself, but letting McTominay go is fine. But when you go away to Brentford and you go away to Arsenal or to West Ham and you struggle in midfield, well, no shit, Sherlock.
Yeah.
Manchester United aren't ready to bring in a superstar to take them to win the league. And what Carrick can do is, he may ultimately be short of getting them to win a league title, right? And this is where I completely disagree with, say, the mindset of Keane. Because they, all that class of 92, are trying to talk about winning titles again. Just be there or thereabouts for a year or two. And if Carrick fails, but ultimately then he builds the structure. I was chatting to someone recently where one of the kids went to Manchester United on trial and said it's a shambles. They're all slagging each other off, all of that stuff. And you need to get the house in order and get someone at top of the tree that can do that. And Carrick does that. The bonus point is if he actually turns out to be good enough to go and win something.
Mm.
If he's not, grand, you do what Liverpool done. And Rodgers never got the credit for this, but he built structures underneath. He was there when they were rebuilding Melwood and putting first-class facilities in. Ultimately, he failed. Wasn't good enough to get them over the line. And Klopp came in, and Klopp's job was easier to a point, and he obviously done the magic. And Manchester United need to do something like that where what he could do is they could let Carrick get them, say, fourth and go, right, we need Pochettino, Tuchel, whoever it might be, because that's what's going to the noise is going to be. Where, no, just keep building baby steps for another year, be happy with Champions League football. And if Carrick can't get you over the line, come and get the next biggest name at the time. But appointing a Glasner over Carrick is too risky for me.
Yeah.
There isn't enough upsides on that if I was Manchester United board tomorrow.
It's a compelling argument.
It's
really interesting. That point, the Rodgers one, is fascinating as well. Because it does, it makes a good degree of sense. An awful lot of sense.
They're not ready to be winning league titles yet.
No.
Now, if you think about it, it's not that far off either, which is mad to think, because we were talking about them 6 months ago being a mid-table Premiership team. Mm. But why are they not that far off? Because who have we to beat at the moment? City, who are average in City terms, and Arsenal, who are excellent, but that's all. Yeah. So the jump is not huge, yeah. but it is structurally, it's huge. It's huge. And that's where a lot of people struggle with going, like, thinking it's all about the first team. And it's like, ultimately, it's not about sorting out the under 13s, 14s, 15s, but it's about fixing your club first. And people hate that DNA and all of that stuff. I get why people hate that, because they only want, a lot of fans only want what goes out into Old Trafford in a week, but they're all the sum of the part. And you asked me why Brentford are doing so well, because structurally he has 21, 22, 24 year old, he's the nucleus of a really strong, young, fit, hungry team who probably all want to move to Manchester United.
Yeah.
But they've got to do it for him first. And United don't have that. They fixed a lot of stuff, but they haven't fixed all of the sum of the parts yet. It's a little bit too noisy, I think, for a Tuchel or someone like that to come in, or an Angelotti. I think fix your club first for a year or two. Now, while you're in Champions League, like, don't leave Carrick in there if you're sixth and seventh or whatever. Like, but if he gets them Champions League and it continues to be, you know, revenues that come with that, I think he deserves the chance. I think if you look down your nose on that, you're just being a snob, football snob for the sake of it. And I don't like that disrespect of these people, because the job Andrews and Carrick are doing are great examples of just trust people who know the game.
And even you're realistically, if it comes to pass, I haven't thought too much about this. I wonder now, will Arteta be the first manager to win the league in his first job?
In his first managerial job?
Yeah. I'll think about that. But anyway, it kind of...
I'm only joking. But, sorry.
There you go. Yeah.
But
it's I'll get counters for that.
It's an interesting thing, because it's not that Michael Carrick will be Arteta and enjoy the same success. Who knows what'll happen to that? But I just think that there's the notion that there's a perfect manager is so unique, or that you can predict it. So like, there's certain, like City getting Guardiola, that was kind of a home run. You're like, this something crazy will have to go wrong. Yeah. Liverpool getting Klopp, it was a bit shakier at the start, but it's like, you're like, this guy has enough. But that type of thing seems rarer and rarer.
To give me a chance to explain the Britishness, I think Liverpool and Klopp's a great example of it. Yes, Mane, Salah and Firmino were the kingpins of it. But the job that the likes of Henderson done, Milner done, Andy Robinson done, Van Dijk had a Scottish experience, Southampton experience. There's an element of knowing how to win the ugly games that people don't want to talk about. Not even the ugly games. It's the one where you have to roll your sleeves up. And that's when you hit the sweet spot, when you have that environment in your team. And I'm forgetting one or two, but there's obviously Liverpool's great midfield was Wijnaldum and Fabinho and Henderson.
Yeah. Mm.
But you had Milner coming into there. You had
Oxlade-Chamberlain.
Yeah. There's the other one is gone out of my head. He went to Brighton.
Adam Lallana.
They were part of it. As I said, Andy Robinson, these type of people knew how to win, knew how to play British football. And that's why I complained about, like, McTominay go. He was scoring goals. So you wanted to replace McTominay with the next superstar, where you weren't ready to do that yet.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know hindsight's a wonderful thing, and McTominay now would have done great for United, blah, blah, blah. The standard in Italy maybe isn't as good, so that's helping them. But there's an element of... And one of the things that they're not getting credit for is a lot of signings in Manchester United. I don't know whether you've noticed this, that Wilcox has got hammered for lots of different reasons. A lot of the signings recently have played in the Premiership.
Yeah, and Bumo and Cunha and others.
And I think that's a huge thing.
They've tweaked it for sure.
Yeah. They haven't been bringing in these, like, Garnachos and people who haven't experienced it yet. So there's an element of them learning from that.
There was also a time where they were bringing in, you know, strikers like Igalo and these older strikers. And even they had the option to buy Emi Martinez, it seemed, from Villa, but they decided, you know what, we'll go with the younger guy, the next David De Gea potentially, instead of Lamin. So they've changed that as well. But it's funny you're talking about, even like, when I think about the positives of Carrick and Andrews, particularly like body language, like Thomas Franken is... His press conferences, particularly towards the end, a little bit aloof, you know, even the fact that he didn't know about Christian Romero's disciplinary record, like he's walking out holding an Arsenal mug. I won't really hold that against him. He obviously did that by accident. But even Ruben Amorim, you know, sitting in the dugout for the Grimsby game with the tactics board out, like, jumps to mind. And then you see the likes of, you know, Carrick. Obviously the players get on with him. Casemiro's jumping on his shoulders last night. Andrews is jumping on Jordan Henderson's back when the equaliser goes in. Even the way he picks up a yellow card, Andrews, and like he's almost getting the crowd behind him. Yeah. He wants to... kickstart something. You're playing the best team in the league, and
I'm a bit cynical on that stuff though.
Right, okay.
Right,
the getting the yellow card,
because you know what you're on the edge of being David Brent type or being a genius when it comes to management, and you're in the glare of the media,
like Liam Rossini.
I Liam Rossini is the worst example of him. I don't think he's helping himself, but look, I just feel a bit cynical about that stuff. I mean, if Keith was losing games and he got that yellow card last night, there'd be people, you know what I mean? So there's a fine balance with it. I felt, and I said it about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I think Thomas Franks has failed with that Tottenham Hotspur. He's had better players than what he's done. He can't have too many complaints about getting the sack. Can Sean Dyche? Yeah, probably. Can... But Thomas Franks can't, I don't think. I think he's not done a good job with them players he has. I know they've had lots of injuries, etc. But they should have done a lot better than where they are. And ultimately, you take responsibility. Talking about someone getting the sack is so hard. If someone used to manage, blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, he's walking away 4 or 5 million. It's a first world problem, pal. He'll work again.
Hard to feel sorry for him.
But... I don't think he's done a great job personally.
No.
Can I address two of the haters here? Just first of all, Nigel, for God's sake, Arthur, Pep won literally everything in his first job, including 2 Champions Leagues. Specifically meant Premier League.
Yeah.
First job. That was clear enough, I think. We weren't, you know, I remember, as Vinny in the room has won something in the first managerial job.
Yeah, no,
it's not different. A thing. Second one is from Carl Dillon. Klopp was shaking in the first year at Liverpool. What? He took over a Basque case and brought them League of Final. Yeah, no, I absolutely think they finished 8th. And it was more so referring to the fact that a lot of people were like, oh, this high-intensity football won't work, players are getting injured, so on and so forth.
And his name has gone away from me, but he was a genius of strength and conditioning at the time, absolutely hammered Klopp over the amount of hamstrings injuries he had. His name is gone. He was part of a lot of coaching courses and stuff like that. But, Klopp wasn't shaky.
No,
but he took Liverpool were in a bad position at the time. So that's just the point about Rodgers. People will probably criticise me saying he'd done a good job at Liverpool because he left them a basket case, because when it goes wrong, it went spectacularly wrong, like for a while, and he had to fix that.
And I was proceeding that by saying Klopp was a very obvious choice. That was the point of that. He was a very straightforward, which they are very rare.
We should have the address the haters slot every morning.
Gobshite.
Address the gobshite slot. We have to discuss the Nations League draw, lads, as well, because we are keeping a keen eye on this one. Obviously, the World Cup will take centre stage. Hopefully, Ireland can qualify. But regardless, we're going to have some games in the UEFA Nations League starting later in the year. And naturally enough, Ireland have drawn Israel. Kosovo and Austria, isn't it, the other two teams in the Irish group? So
it's amazing.
It's
who are the other teams? Nobody really knows.
This is it. Like, it obviously, this is going to take centre stage, and I was fascinated to listen to Gavin Cooney on the show with the lads last night, and it seems that regardless, these games are going to go ahead, and the FAI were quick to come out with their statement after the draw came in yesterday, and to just say, well, look, we've done what we can, we've addressed the issue with UEFA last year and made it clear that the FAI do not want Israel competing at international level. And Hemel Hagrimsson is the unfortunate one who's over at the draw, and he's obviously been thrust in front of the media. And he reiterated his own point that he agreed with the FAI decision to ask UEFA whether or not the Israelis should be in the tournament. But this is going to be an issue that's going to drag on for a little bit of time. Israel have been playing their home games in Budapest. Whether or not that's going to be the case remains to be seen. I know some basketball games have been back, as Gavin was saying last night, on in Israel and Jerusalem in recent months. So this is an awkward one, lads. And whether or not Irish fans speak with their money and get rid of their season tickets for this, decide not to go to the Israel game at home, I would be of the opinion, and again, this is full of opinions, and I know it's nuanced, and there's a lot of jobs and money involved in this, so it's not easy. But I would be of the opinion that this should be boycotted by the Republic of Ireland, by the FAI. Maybe this should be put in UEFA's hands, and I find myself nodding in agreement with a lot of what Owen Doyle was saying last night, that this is a situation not of Ireland's doing, and it's going to be a really, really awkward one, and the players are going to be asked about it. It's going to be a complete distraction, and I don't know, Ireland could be in a position here to make a really, really big play, but I'm not too confident that's what's going to happen. I don't know what your take is on it, Vinny.
It's such a difficult one. So the challenge you have is I completely agree with everything you said with one exception. Irish team can't boycott this game. I think that's an unfair suggestion.
For financial reasons?
No, it's not. Like, financial reasons, then do you care more about money or the sort of what's going on there? No, it's not about just that. They're part of... People have this perception that the FAI run football in this country. They don't. They administrate it. And they actually sort of administrate it on behalf of UEFA and FIFA. They're part of that chain. So they can't just go against their governing body and say we aren't playing this game. They can do that, but the ramifications are huge. So playing a game, say, behind closed doors against someone that they're being forced to play is about as good as we can ask for, and if that's what happens, I'm okay with that. This is an absolute horrible situation for the FAI to be in. We have to be careful. It's very easy to say the lines of they should just boycott this and refuse to play it. What are the ramifications for that? For a game, what do UEFA do? There's no doubt UEFA need to make a different decision. I would rather that they were suspended and we didn't have this situation. But that's not the case. So we can't be judge and jury. And it's very easy for the hurlers on the ditch, like opposition political parties, to come out and say this, this and this. Mm. But there's people having to make real difficult decisions at the moment. They need a little bit of breathing space. Let's see what the best case scenario is that the FAI can come up with. But like, shooting statements off about boycott the game, whether it's political parties, whatever, is not easy for the people in that situation. We've got to be careful. And I mean, do I even need to say, like, what is going on is good enough. But there is a bigger picture. And someone has to say this stuff that isn't easy to say. It's very easy for me to get on a soapbox here and be so pro-Palestine. I am. I'm 100%. Any Irishman that isn't doesn't understand the history of the last 150 years. It's terrible what's happening to them. But there's a bigger picture at play, Shane. We just need to give these people a bit of breathing space and let them see what's the best decision they can come up with.
Let's say the ramifications, if Ireland were to boycott the game, were a fine, a substantial enough fine, and 6 points given to Israel. Would that not still be worthwhile as a statement? You know, you think about the Irish rugby teams that went off to apartheid South Africa, and I'm not equating this to that, but even recognizing Israel after the ongoing war, because the ceasefire is not really a ceasefire, let's be honest, but like, is it a case of finding out from UEFA in advance, as maybe Gavin alluded to last night, what would the ramifications be if we did boycott here, and if they're manageable?
Almost all of the FAI funding comes from UEFA, FIFA, and so I don't want to make about money, because there's people's lives here being lost. It's such a difficult one that I accept we have to talk about it, but I just don't know what plan B is. I don't know. UEFA have to have some sympathy. To be fair to the FAI, they've gone and through their members and they've basically got 94% of their members to agree to this, but basically they've gone to UEFA and said they need to be removed. They're breaking the rules of the association. Mm. So they have been sort of cheerleaders in this. They've been sort of, they've stood up above people. But UEFA haven't made that decision. They've kicked the can on that decision. So the FAI are in a really difficult situation. I know people will shout and they'll come online and they'll tweet and different things and say, just boycott the game, the hell with it. But we need to know what the ramifications are if they do that. Because they could be far-reaching. They could go on for years and years and years, and we have to be very, very careful. It's a really difficult situation for the FAI to find themselves in.
Yeah, it's an awkward one. And look, if the Republic of Ireland-Israel game is played in Dublin, we'll find out the fixtures in due course. As Gavin was saying last night, they have to be, the venues have to be announced maybe 4 months in advance of the fixtures. But that's a, like,
these are for later this year, are they?
Yeah, well,
September,
yeah.
September, October, November, isn't
okay.
it?
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah. I don't think it can be an iron. I think it's a safety risk. I think it needs to be in a neutral venue.
Both games.
If we're, yeah.
Oh, yeah, you can. Yeah.
I think, but like, I echo everything Vinny said there, to be honest with you. It's difficult. I completely respect your opinion as well. It's difficult to say anything definitively.
Yeah.
Now, I do think, like, there's probably things, I'd be very interested, because again, you're not going to dictate whatever should happen. I'd be very interested to see whether the games are broadcast, whether the games, how they're covered. Different aspects like that, because it does seem impossible at this stage that whatever happens is going to be treated as usual, or even the facade of it being treated as usual. Mm-hmm. But it's an incredible thing, and it's funny. I was talking to Dara outside earlier, and he made the point about the way that basketball was approached comparatively.
Yeah.
And that, for that one, I suppose, because we're all a little bit more detached. He was kind of making the point, like, that it was so much more black and white. It was like, oh, just boycott it, don't play it. Simple as that. Mm. And we do probably, and this one, we're probably, obviously you have your same strong opinion on it, but we're probably a little bit more guilty of being kind of nuanced, because we see, you, for instance, know exactly what would happen if X money was removed from thing. Mm. And you can see the whole chain of events on and on and on. So it is different. Is it like your whole perspective changes depending on your information on it and everything? But like
if the fine was €1 million,
yeah,
I think I'd say as an Irish nation, we would go, okay, we'll give the FAI that, we'll pay the fine for them, whether it's through government or we do a phone in and we do a I don't want to be flippant, because as I keep saying, there's people's lives are.
Yeah,
I'm okay if that's what the consensus is, and that's the biggest fallout from boycotting the game, Shane, is say €1 million fine and 6 points to Israel. Okay, I'm okay with that, and I'll back that 100%. You know, I'll nearly go and say, and I'm not trying to defend myself here because I had a different view on you. I'm saying I nearly go and say, and I'll go to war for the people who are being terrorized, for want of a better word, but I just need to know what the ramifications are for this. The people in power are UEFA / FIFA at the moment, and what is the knock-on effect of this? And I just need to see that forced for the bigger picture.
Yeah.
And it's as I said, it's horrible for me even to have to try and make that argument, but I still think we need to give people a bit of time.
Yeah. The one thing I don't agree with, some people in the YouTube comments are suggesting we shouldn't mix sport and politics.
Yes.
It's absolutely ridiculous.
Yes. Unfortunately, that's...
It's so intertwined nowadays, especially you see the FIFA and Trump stuff and you know...
That's wishful thinking. Like,
even though, was it the skeleton, the Ukrainian skeleton?
Oh, the helmet,
The helmet wasn't allowed.
So, to just play that out for 1 second. Say we ignore the politics of it and we play Israel in the Aviva Stadium, right? And someone makes that flippant comment. And there's whatever, God forbid, there is.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
Then we're all filled for allowing the game happen. Yeah. The Irish government are completely criticised. The guards are criticised. There's an attack on something in that stadium.
Yeah.
Where there's 40, 50, 000. So you can't not mix politics and sport. You have to do it, because you can't send an Israel team into the Aviva Stadium and go, it'll be grand, Jack. No, it won't be. So you have to. That's a nonsense argument, I'm afraid.
It is. You've had, like, it was only, I forget what the game was. What was the game of the night with the explosion in the Stade de France?
Oh, yeah, was it France-Germany? No.
Sorry.
I know the game,
I didn't even mention it, I don't know it, but, like, it's just, it's nonsense, but sure.
Yeah. Well, this is not going to go away. We're going to be talking about this for quite some time. And if there is a game in Dublin, I don't know if there would be a game in Dublin. Maybe if it, maybe it's in Dublin behind closed doors. But even that is a security risk. People, you know, people will gather. So this is going to be something that's going to roll on for the next while, I'd imagine. On a completely separate note, lads, this is one I mentioned to you yesterday, Arthur, as well, in Gaelic games. I haven't said this one to you in advance, Vinny, but in the McCrory Cup in Gaelic games, they have started splitting opposition fans up a la football style. You know when you go to Croke Park and you go to an inter-county match and you could have Patsy from Donegal behind you throwing insults at you and you're from Monaghan or whatever, and it kind of adds to the atmosphere a little bit. But Cara O'Kane is making this call for a long time that to improve the atmosphere at Gaelic Games matches, you separate the fans, you create a buzz, maybe you get some chance going, I don't know. But apparently at the Athletic Grounds in the McCrory Cup, it worked brilliantly. A lot of people were saying it added to the occasion, and the Abbey CBS comeback was partly due to the fans all in one section getting behind them. I know, Arthur, you have views on this as well. I'd like to see it. I'd like to try it. I'd love to be at a game in Croke, like a massive All-Ireland semi-final, say, in Croke Park, say in the hurling, Limerick and Cork, but all the Limerick fans are together, all the Cork fans are together. I think the noise would be exponentially greater. And it's already great for those big events, but I think in GAA, and it cuts out any form of potential scraps or rows in the stands. Not that that really happens, but...
Not too much.
What's your take?
Sometimes. What's my take? I don't know. I'd never had a problem with it, so I don't think I'd be going changing for the sake of it. Now, it's fun. You've been in away ends with, like... To be fair, I've never been in a home or away end that's been more or less balanced.
Right, yeah.
I've never been to a cup final or something like that, of that magnitude, of an 80,000 magnitude. Like that's I've never been to that. So
but you've been,
that
a, you've been
like.
In a Premier League away end.
Been in a Premier League. It's class. Like yeah.
It feels like it's wrong to even suggest what you're suggesting, right? Mm. And I've limited, but like I went down to Parky Creeve and watched the two semi-finals of the sort of club game, and it was just brilliant, the people coming in and out, the mixture of people, all of that stuff, people up and down, and that sense of community that the GAA have is something, as a soccer man, I'd be really jealous of. But the away ends in, like, to go to any Premier League game as an away fan, or any game as an away fan, is like, that's what football's all about. That's the moment, you know, like where when you play and you coach, you know what you miss? Like, you go on a away trip, say, to... I remember being in Warsaw. I'm going for a walk today. The game, lads went for a sleep. And seeing the fans and seeing having the beer or, you know, the crack of the can on the train. And like, that's what sport's all about. So going to... Having a few away things would probably bring more fans back into the GAA. So if Dublin... went and travelled as in away fans and Pacific and had the chance, I'd say there'd be a few lads would tag along to that. Yeah. And he might bring, us Dubs might bring a bit more trouble than you'd want. But
I found the Dublin away fans at league games in particular, always brilliant. They're amongst the best.
I remember
away
being
sport.
At Dublin Longford years ago. I was playing for Longford Town at the time. And they were just battering Longford after a while, and then they just start singing "Your soccer team's from Dublin." Like it was a great chant, and every one of us was from Dublin at the time. So
the comments are already split here, lads.
You'd do it. You'd be all for it.
I'm all for trying it. I would love an Ulster final where, say for example, my own county were playing Tyrone.
It's in Clonus, and you're...
It's in Clonus, but half the ground is completely split.
But it depends on the ground, but is it a compromise? Like so like what you're saying, Clonus is a good one, isn't it?
Cause yeah. Not,
if you had two ends, so a Dublin end, say a Monaghan end, and then the floating fan family sections on either side. But I'd say the biggest scrap for the tickets would be for both away ends, Arthur, to be fair. So I'd say it would work like...
There's a few comments coming in on this. Shane, possibly worst suggestion ever on OTB. Are you actually 12 years of age, says Dennis? Well, it wasn't my suggestion. It was actually something I'd seen Cara O'Kane making the point on social media. Exactly. So I was just making the point. Aaron says, all Ireland's in the 90s where one team was designated a specific end always made it better. Offaly on the Hill in 98 was my greatest memory. People pointing out that Ireland away games are what it's all about. Azerbaijan, Georgia, Moldova, places you'd never visit, which is a fair point also. Ben O'Connor will be happy with fan segregation, more importing from soccer. Well, that's one thing the GAA hate taking anything from football.
Oh, get over
association
yourselves.
Football.
Just get over yourself and embrace it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Just lean into it.
Names on the back of the jerseys and all, it has to come.
I'd be all for it. Let's try it. Let's see what happens.
It's an interesting theory, though. It's an interesting. Yeah. I don't know how it would work. There'd obviously be so much logistical stuff as well, because do you then have to be? How do you approach a game as a neutral?
Mm.
Yeah. So you have you could.
So you just have sections. Okay. So yeah,
singing sections, as they call them, football, like, or whatever.
Mm. And
like,
then
500 lads from Derry in Richmond Park about 2 years ago. Wherever I ended up sitting, I never sit in the posh seats in Richmond. Some will say there's none, but I always sit near the Derry fans, and I just love sitting beside them. They just sing for 60 minutes. Brilliant.
Yeah.
I know we have to go. What's your favourite League of Ireland ground? All allegiances notwithstanding.
Go to Keegan.
To play in and or managing?
Richmond.
Okay. Both?
Yeah, Richmond to play in and to be involved in, yeah. Mm.
That
yeah.
is class.
Yeah, I love
Richmond. Living by it, I go past it.
Yeah.
We might touch on some League of Ireland later on.
No, it's not the best. Different argument, but Richmond.
Okay, that's my favourite sort of one.
I've just seen some photographs as well of Talca Park ahead of the big game, Shelburne and Shamrock Rovers tonight, and the pitch does look in a bit of bother. A lot of water lying on the ground in Talca Park. I don't know if the photos were taken last night or this morning, but we'll keep an eye on that one. Shelburne, Shamrock Rovers, one of the games tonight, 8 p.m. at Talca Park is that one.